This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, and what a bun fight. From everyone to be last on match of the day. But in my experience, the less exciting the football, the more exciting the podcast or something like that. Manchester United are the star performers by a long way, battering Spurs. Casemiro, Fred and Fernandes just too much in midfield. Hugo Lloris made close to 1,000 saves as Conte's side falls short against another of the big six. Ronaldo didn't get on, but still made it all about himself. The next best game, probably at Selhurst Park, where Palace come from behind to beat Wolves with Eze, Elise and Zaha, all delivering on the same night. Elsewhere, it was all very binary. Darwin Nunez shows that actually football probably is his sport as Liverpool just about squeezed past West Ham. Miguel Almiron is still taking that Grealish stick personally to give moral high grounds Eddie Howe another home win. There's a slight upswing in the topsy-turvy world of Ralph Hasenhüttl. A classic Brighton are good but can't score, and the bright lights of West London prove too much for Brentford and Chelsea. All that plus the Ballon d'Or, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Johnny Liu.
Hello.
And hello, Troy Townsend.
Hi, Max.
Had a lot of questions like this. Jim saying, should Tory cabinet ministers start applying for the Wolves and Bournemouth jobs, given that Premier League managers have greater job security? Brett, not a question, just to say I'll be proudly enjoying my tofu throughout the pod. David says, now that the pod is so powerful, it can topple ministers. Is it good for the pod game? If other pods can't compete, then what's the point? I think that's related to me tweeting about Suella Braverman quite shortly before she resigned. And Michael says, how upset are Amazon that everyone paid attention to what happened in Westminster rather than the football last night? I don't know, Troy, if they are that upset, given Man United aside, it was a dreadful night of football, wasn't it?
I'm not going to endorse that match just in case any of the fans of those clubs are listening in for this one.
That's all the fans.
I'll just say that it wasn't a great night for goals. We were really scratching for entertainment. Amazon, yeah, their first round of matches for the week, the Premier League, not groundbreaking. Listen, the two main games, Man United, obviously Spurs, which I know we'll discuss, and then, you know, Liverpool West Ham was an interesting one as well, wasn't it? So it will be interesting to discuss it with everybody else.
Yeah, it's a bit like Channel 4 getting the England games, then suddenly England just falling off a cliff, wasn't it? Yes, Barry?
Well, but before we discuss the actual football, I don't really understand why Amazon want this Premier League, these fixtures. I mean, their coverage is nothing out of the ordinary. They're about 3 minutes behind the action. The games keep stopping so the players can buffer for 4 or 5 minutes, and the pictures aren't very good.
And isn't the point that, you know, they just want people to sign up to Amazon Prime and then forget they've signed up to Amazon Prime, and then they get £6 a month. Although it's not global. Like, you know, in Australia, you don't watch it on Amazon. You know, no, like you watch it from the rights holders. So it's just a UK thing. Anyway, let's start at Old Trafford. Manchester United were really good. I mean, they battered Spurs there, Johnny, didn't they?
Yeah, it was probably the most complete performance of the Ten Hag era so far. And, you know, whereas in a lot of their previous games, they've tended to become a little bit bogged down in the final third, and kind of everyone sort of running towards the centre. There was a real cohesion and a flow and a rhythm to them. And Spurs were not great. To a large extent, United didn't allow them to be great. The pressing, the way they kind of pinned Spurs in, won the territorial battle, and they got their fullbacks forward, which is, you know, once you win the territorial battle and you get the fullbacks forward, Dallow and Shaw had good games. You are always going to create chances with that kind of front line, and you know, Rashford missed a couple. I think, you know, it could even have been more than two. Fernandes seems to have been, I think, stung by a little bit of the criticism that he's got recently. He chipped in. Yeah, very, very, very encouraging performance for United.
They had more shots in the first half than anyone else in a Premier League game this season, and the most Man United have had in the first half since Sir Alex Ferguson. Barry, you did the minute by minute. Who impressed you?
Hugo Lloris impressed me. Because, and he was probably the only Tottenham player who impressed me, because if it wasn't for him, they'd have been absolutely slaughtered. He made some splendid saves. On the Manchester United side, I thought Fred was very good. I thought Bruno Fernandes was very good. I think Rashford was quite unlucky on another night. He might have had two or three. And Diogo Dalot was very impressive, and he's a player that I haven't been... I wouldn't say I've been unimpressed with him. I just haven't really noticed anything he's done up to now, but he was very good last night. Casemiro was decent again. The consensus seems to be that was probably United's best performance under Erik ten Hag, and I don't disagree, but I wonder how much you can judge that when you consider just how awful Tottenham were. They were like a non-league team who were having their big day out at Old Trafford in the third round of the Cup and were, you know, sitting back, hoping to soak up pressure and hopefully nick a goal. That didn't happen. Harry Kane and Heung-min Son were, you know, they might as well not have been on the pitch, really, in terms of Spurs going forward. Spurs had this extra man in midfield who was of no advantage to them whatsoever because they were completely overrun. And Antonio Conte, who, having said before the game that this was the perfect time for this difficult test for his players and that you were going to Old Trafford was like, you know, going into the monster's den to take him on the top level of a platform video game. They were so meek, and he did absolutely nothing to change anything until nearly 80 minutes were up. So I think he made one substitution on 77 minutes and a couple more on 82, and that was it. It just seemed bizarre.
They have very little. They basically have nothing on the bench.
It must have been worth, you know, taking a punt. I mean, they were getting slaughtered. I'm not sure, whatever the dearth of quality on the bench, it can't have been much worse than what was on the pitch.
Troy, how much, before we go into Tottenham and Conte, which I think Barry's done quite well there, like you have to credit Ten Hag, to, you know, because Manchester United there, if they do that, and obviously there's always two teams in a football match and you have to look at one playing badly and one playing well and who lets another not play well or not. They just look to be a shape and a style to Manchester United that I haven't seen from donkeys.
I'm going to be honest. I'm not going to get carried away with Man United's performance. It's the kind of performance we should expect. A club like that should be producing. You know, they're playing a Tottenham side who are very rigid, who have got a plan to sit deep, and they've got the players to be able to counteract that plan and create chances. This is what Man United should be. They played like it. The best performance for me in a real great game was the performance against Arsenal. That performance for me, and then what happened after that. So I'm not going to get overly excited until we see some consistency from this side, you know, from certain players who turn it on 1 minute and decide that they can't be bothered the next, you know. But the shape has looked better with Casemiro in there. I will praise him. He wasn't the best player on the park yesterday, but I think he's given them a stability that they haven't had and a reliability to do his job. And I think since a lot of the Man United players, particularly in that area of the park, have just not been doing their job and not been doing it very well. So I don't know why it's taken him so long to integrate, but, you know, he's in there now and I think he's making people around him play better.
Yeah, Shane does say, how did Fred not win the Ballon d'Or? It's the greatest travesty in sport. But he was excellent. On to Spurs, Johnny. They have been comprehensively outplayed by Chelsea, Arsenal and Manchester United this season. They somehow got a point against Chelsea. I mean, is that their limit, that Conte can make them beat all the teams below them but do nothing against the teams in and around them?
It's quite a small sample size. I mean, first of all, those three games were away from home, Chelsea, Man United and Arsenal, and they settled into a certain pattern where, you know, they ended up soaking up a lot of pressure and playing without the ball and getting camped in their own half. The fact is, Spurs actually aren't as good as any of those teams. They're not as good as City, Liverpool, Arsenal, United on this floor. I don't think they're as good as Newcastle. And a part of that is kind of Conte's projection. You know, he's been moaning all year basically about the quality of the squad that he's inherited, and you know, haranguing the board for not doing more in the transfer market. And it's quite clear that he has set his team up to cover what he feels are their very significant limitations. And what that ends up doing, that does two things. You end up playing in quite a rigid, basically it's plan A and it's plan A and it's plan A. And, you know, you don't really have a lot beyond, you know, just try and counter, get Son and Kane up there. And the other thing it does is mentally, they look like players who, I don't know, they just don't seem to believe in themselves. So much negativity, so much, you know, sideways, pointless sideways passing around the defence. Like they don't expect to have the ball and they don't feel like they're good enough to have the ball. That's probably, you know, that the biggest difference against the biggest teams, because they will punish you if you give them sort of 60% possession and you know 25 shots. They are going to find a way through. That's probably, you know, the pattern of their season against you know mid-table teams. They've been able to I feel like I've been talking about for about 4 or 5 minutes now, but you know I feel like I've made all the
you can stop. You've made a good point. We can carry on.
I'm sure I end it, but that's how I'm going to end it.
Not many panelists self-edit. It's a wonderful thing. If everybody could, it would be great. John says, was Ronaldo justified in trying to make it inside to catch the 10 o'clock news? It was. Yeah. Unless there's something we don't know about Barry, it seems totally ridiculous.
Yeah, it looks like a fit of petulance. And look, I was thinking about it. It's like I remember once years ago I flounced out of a WhatsApp group over some perceived slight and immediately felt like a massive twat, and I'm sure all my mates were laughing at me, and that's probably what happened there. Maybe he realised, crikey, the penny dropped, this team is better without me. Oh my God, and he had an existential crisis. Maybe he was really desperate to go to the loo. But Erik ten Hag didn't seem particularly impressed afterwards. He said, you know, I saw what happened. I haven't spoken to him. I'll deal with it tomorrow. But yeah, it's not a great look. And to make it all about him on a night when Manchester United have just beaten big rivals so comprehensively is juvenile.
I think if he did need the loot, he should have walked as if he needed the loo, and then we'd have all perhaps understood. And I'm not sure he'd actually look back and think, maybe I'm a massive twat. I don't know if Ronaldo has that in his locker. Anyway, Liverpool 1, West Ham 0. This game, Troy, was all about Darwin Nunez, wasn't it? It felt like almost a complete striker's performance, actually.
Perfect for him. The kind of game that he actually needed, and being the only goal scorer kind of finished it off, to be totally honest. Listen, he's taking his time to get into the Premier League and get up to the pace. And obviously the sending off against Crystal Palace did him no favours at all. But he's getting there. He's getting up to speed. His last couple of performances have been not too bad. You can see him actually like being in that Liverpool front three now and being the nuisance that they need him to be. But ultimately, when you pay that amount of money, it's goals that you're counted on. And because Haaland has started like a house on fire, people are looking at him as if he's a really bad signing. But I think that would have done him the world of good. You know, West Ham are a good side. Let's not take it away. I think this is a more competitive game than the Spurs-Man United game, because West Ham, you know, they're on the upward trend again. And I think they'll be disappointed that they didn't come away with anything last night. Suchek's chance right at the end. You know, it's a Milner block. It's an Alisson save, but it really should be in the back of the net. And they've obviously Bowen's had the penalty saved as well. So they'd be massively disappointed. But as a number nine, as someone who's going to be the vocal point of, you know, Liverpool's side, I think, for the future, it was a massive night for him. And I think he proved a lot of the doubters, you know, wrong. And he can play in the Premier League and score goals in the Premier League.
Yeah, good to get your first totally honest comment.
Did I say totally honest?
Right. Okay, mate. Johnny, was there anything you saw from Darwin Nunez that you sort of hadn't seen before? Or is this just of the nature of football discourse that we write people off and then say they're great next week, a bit like we wrote Spurs off like 2 minutes ago?
No, I think the confidence certainly seems to be there, and I think he will always suffer from the eye test, Nunez, because he's such a gangly, awkward, angular player. I think he suffers from looking a bit like Andy Carroll, and I think there's some sort of, you know, deep seated trauma amongst a lot of Liverpool fans that they've signed another Andy Carroll. But no, I mean that's the sort of game he's there to win. You know, the game that you might actually not really deserve to win, and it's just, you know, a header, an aerial battle, and it's the only goal of the game. That's what he's, you know, he had this volley, didn't he? He had a there was a volley from like 20 yards and it comes back to him and he tries again and it basically hits the corner flag. And that is the Faustian pact that you sign up to when you sign Darwin Núñez. You know, he's all about volume, and that volume is not always going to be in terms of goals and assists and shots. Sometimes it's going to be in terms of like pure chaotic entertainment. But you know, whether that fits with kind of how Liverpool are playing or want to play at the moment, I'm still not sure. But there are also going to be nights where he wins you games like that.
Barry, I'm not sure Troy gave James Milner quite enough credit for that ridiculous block in the last minute.
Oh, I thought it was incredible. At first, I thought Souček had just pulled the ball wide without any interference. But then the replay, I clocked that Milner had stuck out the leg and diverted what would have been a certain goal. And he's just fantastic, isn't he? A great advertisement for healthy living, like myself.
Absolutely right. Two peas in a very strange pod, you and James Milner. And actually, Trent Alexander-Arnold was quite lucky that didn't go in, because he'd really lost his man really quite easily in the build-up to that moment. Jarrod Bowen obviously missed the penalty.
The comparison of James Milner and Barry Glendening has done me for the night. So, wow. Physical specimens, you.
One's a control experiment, and one is... What happens when you don't live your life that way? Paul says, is Ali McCoist giving Declan Rice man of the match in a losing team unique? And should it happen more often? I thought it was quite an interesting point, Troy, that we, you know, you can be the best player on the pitch and not win. Yet man of the match is always given to just whoever scored the last goal that the person that's the pundit has seen.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good precedent to set. I mean, it has been done on a few occasions, but yeah, we far too often stick with the winning side, and if someone grabs something late that has done nothing throughout the game, by the way, it's almost, oh, let's give it to them, you know. So it's a good spot from Ali, because again, Declan proving his worth, proving his quality on the biggest stage, and when you're away from home as well, it shows the magnitude of his performance and how he was driving that West Ham team on to try and, you know, to get something. And I think it should be happening more often. You know, ultimately, if you're the best player, you're the best player. And I just wonder what some of the pundits are looking at when they give, you know, the player of the match, when they give out the trophy. I'm not quite sure what they're looking at half the time when they're dissecting a game that they have obviously commentated on for so long. But it almost seems like it's just convenience. Well, it's convenient to give it to the winning side. It's convenient to give it to a player on that side. But that is totally disrespecting the performances, the very good performances of some of the other players. And I think that's really good from McCoist to do that, to be totally honest. I've done it again, but never mind. McCoist to do that, because it then shows the quality of the game. I like that. It shows the quality of the game and the quality of the opposition.
I just want to mention John Abrahams, who the Lancashire captain, I think it was the 1984-85 Benson and Hedges Cup final, who won the Player of the Match award for, despite not scoring a run or taking a wicket. It's one of my favourite Man of the Match awards. He won it for his captaincy, for his inspirational captaincy. And I think there should be more awards like that.
Diogo Jota's likely to be out of the World Cup after suffering a calf muscle injury in the game against Manchester City. Jurgen Klopp was in the dugout yesterday. He's been charged with a breach of FA Rule E3, which covers comments which are improper, which bring the game into disrepute, which are threatening, abusive, indecent or insulting. He apologised for his reaction in his post-match comments. He's got until Friday to answer the charge. Do you think you might as well, you know, if a player can get sent off and banned for the next game, seems odd that, you know, the manager has a few more days to answer that charge. I don't know what you think, Baz.
Yeah, it doesn't really make much of a difference, does it? I mean, most of the work is done away from the touchline. I did notice, actually, when West Ham got the spot kick yesterday, I was looking to see would Jurgen lose his mind at the touchline, but he was pointedly very calm and not in any way aggressive towards the linesman or the fourth official. He's had a lot of nonsense to put up with the last few days with these anonymous briefings from City coming out. Someone at City briefing favoured journalists, client journalists who've been writing all sorts of rubbish about Jurgen Klopp. And there's talk he may be suing one of the broadsheets because they apparently described him as xenophobic, which he's many things. I suspect he is anything but a xenophobic.
And interestingly, you know, after those pretty vile chants from the City fans, and I phrased it really badly actually on the last pod where I went down that ridiculous route of, you know, every club has fans like this, it's a tiny minority. Like, that's irrelevant, isn't it? The chants were pretty disgusting. I don't know how you stop it, but one way of stopping it would be for that the club that those fans support coming out and really criticising. You know, that they're not going to listen to people saying this, these chants about, but they might listen to their own club. As far as I know, City haven't called it out, right? And that is a really important part of this process. If your fans do something bad, you as a club have to call it out. The fans are going to listen to you more than they listen to anybody else, whether they listen to them or not.
You know, this is not the first time and it won't be the last time. There are clubs that know that they've got a section of fans that, you know, sing songs that, you know, in this day and age, they're never right anyway, but they've been accepted and allowed. And obviously we hear them on the television, or if you're in the stadium, we hear it and no one does anything about it. This is the clubs and their police forces that they work with being proactive and identifying people and then going in and eliminating those people from the terraces. Until they start doing that, the fear of clubs to get involved with their fan bases and you know, we don't want to upset them. What do you mean don't want to upset them? They're upsetting so many people with the chanting. They know that there's no action against them, so they continue to chant. So this is the Premier League, the English Football League, the police forces, the clubs, all coming together to eliminate it. We have chants all over the country. Chelsea, Spurs, West Ham, Arsenal, name them all. Man City, Liverpool, Man United, name them all. So actually, it's a large majority that are getting away with these chants during match days, and football and the police force turn a blind eye to it because it's mass chanting. So if there's something really needs to be done, it needs to be done right across the board rather than highlighting it because of a high-profile game, you know, where you know, all the conversation comes out about what's gone on around it. So actually, there's an opportunity here for all the police forces and the clubs to work together and be more proactive in this space.
Apart from it being the right thing, you know, how are we going to get clubs to do that?
Premier League have got stamped down on it. Premier Leagues have got to tell the clubs, it's do what is right, or you'll face a sanction, or you'll face some kind of fine. You know, we've got the most high-tech cameras around our football grounds now, and I will not have it that they can't identify people because there's, I don't know, more than three of them that are singing a song. Identify people. Give the stewards the power, by the way, to identify them as well without fear, and then deal with it. It shouldn't be that difficult, but when it's things like this, we always create a difficulty around it where we don't have any outcomes. And it's a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. So football needs to tidy itself up, and those owners of the clubs and the fan bases, you know, there's all these support groups as well. We've got to start coming together to eliminate it from our grounds.
I couldn't agree more with you, Troy, but until right at the end there, you were talking as if the Premier League and the clubs are some separate entity. They're self-governing and they clearly just can't be bothered with the hassle.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Listen, I'm just saying that the Premier League need to identify it, come down hard on the clubs, give them a period of time to identify people and to make sure that, you know, if they are entering the ground, that if they are singing songs like that, that they deal with it, or else the Premier League have the final say. But I don't think we're anywhere near that stage. That's the worst thing. We're nowhere near that stage. So it means that people can confidently go into a ground and know that if they sing a song that... I don't even want to say about the songs that are being sung, to be totally honest, that they're going to get away. There's no action. There's no accountability. It's fine. It's all right. We're in a mob. It's okay. Don't worry about it. They'll never get us all. That can't be the attitude that we have in and around stadiums, surely.
No, I agree with you. All right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Selhurst Park.
I'm Grace Dent.
And I'm back. Friends, it's time for your fourth helping of comfort eating from The Guardian. Join me with more celebrity guests like Dono Porter, Graham Norton and Mallory Blackman as we throw the fridge doors wide open on the comfort foods that have seen them through.
You'll notice I'm talking a lot. That's because I'm hoping somewhere along the way I don't have to eat it.
the level of devilment in your face.
Comfort Eating returns on the 18th of October with new episodes released every Tuesday. Comfort Eating with me, Grace Dent, is supported by Ocado.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly, 17th of November at Earth in Hackney, a live show. Me, Barry, Lars Sivertsen, Ellis James, via live stream around the world as well. You can watch on catch up if you can't watch it live. Please come and we'll have a beer with you afterwards in the pub. And hopefully by the end, Barry will be singing about Troy Townsend's luggage again. Go to theguardian.com/guardianlive if you want to come to that. Crystal Palace 2, Wolves 1. What a shame, Johnny, that Edwards' overhead kick didn't go in. It would have been, on a 2 days of sort of pretty abject football, like the absolute standout moment.
My God, that would have been such a good goal. I mean, Palace in that, particularly in that second half, they made me say something which I've never said before in my life. I was just watching at home on telly, and they made me exclaim something which I've never said before in my life, and probably never will again. They made me say, "Hot damn." I was just sitting there going, "Hot damn!" And then I checked myself. And that's not a phrase I normally use, but it's a testament to. I mean, some of their football is so good. Just you know, the way they you know, Zaha, who I learned on the broadcast is almost 30, which kind of scares me a little bit. But you know, he's right in the peak of his form at the moment. You have Elise, you have Eze, you have Edward, and they look like a team that, you know, that is clicking, that just totally are, you know, they're linking up with each other, they are attuned to each other's rhythms, and yeah, you know, they still concede sloppy goals, and you know, they still look a bit shaky at the back, and you know, they have bad days, but when it all comes together, they are honestly one of the best teams in the Premier League to watch.
And Troy, that is the point of a mid to lower Premier League side, isn't it? For your fans to want to go and watch, because they have the potential to be really exciting.
To be fair, that they got booed off at half time. It wasn't a great first half. Wolves were very good first half. Adama Traore scores a header. I don't know how they've allowed him to do that. But something clicked. Jonathan's right. Something clicked. And, you know, it's the second game on the spin at home. You know, they turned the lead result around. Something clicked. And they just went into this. This is the Palace that I know. The second half is the Palace that I know. And I think it's everything that Patrick Vieira wants from his side, and including all those forward-thinking players at the same time. They just all flicked the switch and turned the gear. Zaha came off the line. He said it in his interview afterwards. He said, "I just came and played inside. I didn't want to hug the touchline." And when he came and played inside, no one knew how to pick him up. And that lights the touch paper for Eze, for Elise, for Edouard. And all of a sudden, they were so expressive and so expansive. It was such a good second half from them. And Wolves just didn't have an answer to it. Although, I think Wolves should have had a pen. I don't know if that's controversy or not, but I thought, I don't know what's going on with VAR and handballs, but for me, Mark Gaye,
I think it hits his knee. Doesn't
it? Did it hit his knee?
I think it is.
What?
Knee,
and then onto his arm, or did it not hit his arm?
I don't think it hit. They really slowed it down.
Match
of the day. They really slowed it down. Clearly, you didn't get to the end. They really slowed it down, and it just comes off his knee, I think. But when I first saw it, I thought that should have been a penalty.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I guess the point is, Barry, is getting those three players specifically, but at the team around them, to do that slightly more often.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably all agree Wolves are having a bad season, and the Crystal Palace fans I know, guys like Kevin Day, Bruce Millington, I see them and hear them talking about how entertaining Palace are to watch, and you would assume Palace are having a good season. But when this game's kicked off, there was only a point between them in the table, which I found quite odd. But yeah, when they get things right, they're a joy to watch. And I mean, Wolves, come on, Adama Traore scores once in an absolute blue moon. And it's such a waste of an Adama Traore goal to go ahead when he scores and not at least get a point from the game.
Yeah, I suppose Neves hit the post with that free kick, but then I think Doucouré hit the post in the first half as well for Palace. Interim manager Steve Davis, he took charge of the game. That's probably his last one, we're not sure. Lots of speculation about Nuno coming back. He's 10-1. Let's go to St James's Park. Newcastle won 10 in the last 14 at St James's Park. Banana Zeb says, Miguel Almiron, name a footballer with a better smile. Bukayo Goal says, has a pod member ever drastically improved their life after being slandered by another pod member, i.e. Almiron and Jack Grealish? It's a brilliant goal, Johnny, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it was. They were really ticking at around that time. Just, you know, I know we've talked on this pod about Bruno Guimaraes, but what a player, a delightful player to watch. And Almiron is just one of those players who has just really come on in that team. There's something about the atmosphere and kind of around the dressing room or whatever, or the feeling around the club and the trust that Howe has put in him. I think he scored 5 goals this season, and you know, it's Almiron, it's Joe Linton, it's Fabian Scher, just all these players who are, you know, they're not new players. These are not sort of, you know, blue chip signings. They are being improved in this team. And, it's become a bit of a cliche to say, like, well, Eddie Howe's done a great job, you know, there is a real success of coaching there. And, you know, there's obviously the whole other side, which has been, you know, discussed, but, purely on a footballing level, there is something quite interesting and exciting happening there.
Yeah, there was one move, Troy, Guimaraes was central to. I think he got the shot away. I can't remember, but it was just like, wow, this is proper flowing football, isn't it?
I mean, I'm not sure if I should be saying this, but I was pleading for it to go in because it was an absolutely great move. And Jonathan's right about his qualities. His qualities are off the scale. And if he had tucked that away, then the plaudits would have been amazing. But yeah, Newcastle played really well. Everton started okay. I was at the game at Spurs on Saturday as well. And, you know, Frank is setting them up in a very similar way that Antonio Conte is setting Spurs up. They sit deep, they soak up, they try and play on the counter. Have they got enough quality going forward at the moment? You know, after unbeaten in 6, they're now 3 on the spin, and you can see the cracks in it. And the cracks in it means that the defence that have done so well is under a little bit more pressure and a little bit more pressure. And Newcastle scored when they were on top, and that's what you've got to do. And from there, the stadium was going crazy. And if they had gone 2 up at that time, I don't think Everton could have said much. But yeah, Frank's probably now waiting until the January transfer window, because I think they need a playmaker. They're playing 3 in the middle there that are competitive. They get in your faces. But if you pass round them, then they almost become like pointless almost. And they've got to find someone that connects the midfield to the front for the front 3 for them to gain points this season. But Newcastle are definitely on the up. And, you know, if they keep going, who knows what the end of the season could look like. But Eddie Howe is proving his qualities with that side. A lot of the players that Steve Bruce had, by the way, and wasn't really performing at all in that team.
Is that person who could connect the midfield and the strike force called Andros?
No, because he'd be one of the strike force. So, and he's not back for a little while.
Yeah, I know. It didn't quite work. I know. It was worth doing. But it didn't quite work.
It was worth a try, but it wasn't.
I mean, Frank Lampard said afterwards, Barry, that he was really pleased with the performance. I thought it was a pretty even game, but they only had one attempt, and Newcastle, I think, had 16. And I think their highlight was Neil Mopai coming on in the wrong colour socks, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, Newcastle deserved to win. I don't think there's any question about that. I did think that shove on Anthony Gordon that led to the flare-up between him and Kieran Trippier and then assorted others, I thought that probably was a penalty, but on the balance of play, I think Newcastle were unquestionably the better team and the worthy winners.
The thing is, Barry, Anthony Gordon's getting a little bit of a reputation as well. You know, inside the box, in and around the box. And the last thing a player like that, whose creativity levels are really good, by the way, and he gets himself into various little situations because of his pace, is to keep doing that. Because once he's got that reputation, then referees look at it, you know, opposition players look at it. And I think that's why the Newcastle players were so upset with him. I agree with you, could have gone either way, but he needs to watch himself a little bit, Anthony Gordon.
David says, I was wondering if a few minutes might be spent to consider the emergence of Eddie Howe's conscience and morality. Great that he's thinking about setting a good example for the children. When asked about, I think, Klopp and sort of behaviour on the touchline, he said, I'm very aware that I'm going to be looked at by millions and millions of people, especially children. I think you have an expectation to make sure the game is upheld in the right way and with the right spirit. Barry.
Why did you have to come?
Philippe's not here.
Oh, Philippe. Yeah, Philippe. There's a clip on Twitter that's worth digging out. It's Philippe on the Irish radio station Off the Ball last night, in which he was as angry as I've ever seen him in his condemnation of Eddie Howe. And this is a very good way of me deflecting and not having to incur the wrath of the Salty Tears Brigade from Tyneside. But he said that Eddie Howe is a dwarf in the face of the big man that Jurgen Klopp is, and how dare he, because, you know, try and take the moral high ground because he's a tool being used by the murderous Saudi state. And he has a point. Another point I'd make is that Eddie Howe's assistant is Jason Tindall, who can be a very obnoxious and obstreperous touchline presence. So, you know, before he starts hurling stones out of his glass house, maybe he should get his own in order. But what Jurgen Klopp did was wrong. But, you know, it wasn't the end of the world.
Yeah, I know. I didn't like Klopp's behaviour. It was interesting. We talked before about what Eddie Howe should or shouldn't or can or can't say.
I've been thinking about this a bit recently, and you know, our job is to kind of. It's to praise and to criticise and to assess, and you know, we suffer no, you know, real, unless you count, like, you know, thousands of bots on Twitter, we don't really suffer negative consequences for speaking our mind. In fact, it's what we're encouraged to do. Eddie Howe is if he comes out and slags off his owners, he's out of a job, you know, and he's unemployed again. And I think there is. Without passing judgment on his choices. Well, I will pass judgment on his choices. I think they're crap. But I think I can see why I can see why he's so oblivious to this. This is his whole world is built around, you know, you might call it this kind of fantasy world, of, you know, football being this force for good, football being, you know, football providing for his family, football, you know, as this obsession that has consumed him ever since he was a kid, and you know, and his whole existence has been about trying to get to the center of that world, and to admit that this world is actually, you know, this kind of evil fantasy, you know, facade, would be totally shattering to his worldview in a way that it isn't to us. So I kind of understand why you choose to, you know, just to drown everything out, you know, and to filter out all the background noise, because it would basically take away a central plank of his identity and his reason for living. So I don't know. I mean, that was the point I wanted to make.
There's an interesting story about Eddie Howe. I think the first ever trans person to work at a football club is someone called, a girl called Sophie Cook, who's the photographer at Bournemouth. And she says that Eddie Howe was incredibly supportive, which is like absolutely amazing. I think she transitioned while she was a photographer at the club. And so she went, Eddie Howe like invited her in, welcomed her in, you know, just sort of got her in front of the squad and said, this is Sophie, you know, carry on everybody, and was amazingly supportive. And I suppose it's that idea with a lot of these arguments and debates that we have is that it's, you know, there is a sort of distance factor where like we care about things that are next door to us, or we, you know, you can be, have a sort of, your morals can exist in a certain sense with your next door neighbours, but if something's 10,000 miles away, it's a slightly different thing. Or that being a human is complicated, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really Paul Doyle did a ex of this parish did a really good interview with her, which is worth looking at. But you know, I just find this focus on Howe on Eddie Howe, which, you know, it's understandable. He's the public face of the organization, but he has no real power. You know, it's not, you know, he can't really do anything. He's certainly not going to, you know, bring it. It's like, you know, it's like having a go. It's like venting your spleen at Hitler's receptionist. You know, he's not the guy who's going to change anything. And it's not, you know, I think realistic to expect anything different from him.
To the Vitality Stadium, Bournemouth 0, Southampton 1. Stateside Saint says, what does Barry make of Southampton winning and holding a clean sheet? Hashtag Ralph in. Cheers from the States.
It's their first clean sheet in 23 games, apparently, which seems a remarkable statistic. I still don't know what to make of them. I thought Bournemouth was the better side, to be honest, but Southampton defended well, rode their luck a little bit. And I thought Bournemouth probably should have had a penalty. And quite interesting, it was a Salisu handball from a junior Stanislas cross. And I'd completely forgotten about the existence of junior Stanislas. So I sort of checked, and he hadn't played since August. I think he presumed he might have been injured. But he's 32 now, so he should probably be called senior Stanislas at this stage, because he just seems to have been around for as long as I can remember. But yeah, hats off to Junior, who's still playing Premier League football. I'd completely forgotten about him. But look, any win away for Southampton is a good win, and because they don't get many of them. So who've they got? They've Arsenal on Sunday. That's a toughie. Let's see how they get on with that.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we will look at the goalless draws. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Phil now saying the tease for this part of we're going to just talk about goalless draws may not have kept as many people listening as I would have hoped. Anyway, we've been nominated for Best Radio Programme. No, that's, well, me and Barry have been nominated for that, but that's not what I'm doing right now. We've been nominated for Best Podcast, haven't we? At the Football Supporters Association Awards. Go to the fsa.org.uk. There's a bit that says awards. Click on that and you'll get your survey. Commentator of the Year from the pod, Robin Cowan. Newspaper of the Year, The Guardian. Online Media of the Year, David Squires. Writer of the Year, Barney and Susie Rack are both nominated. And Football Weekly is nominated, as is the warm-up for me and Baz and Charlie Baker. So, you know, it's very hard to retain these titles. We'd appreciate your votes. Brentford 0, Chelsea 0. I stole Christian's joke for the intro. Was the Brentford-Chelsea game goalless because the players were too distracted by the bright lights of West London? You know, the best moment of this game from a pod point of view was clearly Ethan Pinnock's clearance or his block. You're nodding, Barry. Paul says, was the Ethan Pinnock block better than the Ethan Pinnock goal? Tim Henman, probably not that one, says, Ethan Pinnock was sensational tonight. Does Barry feel personally responsible for his meteoric rise?
No, I don't. I really worry that Ethan Pinnock's going to hear about his cult hero status on the podcast and presume we're taking the piss, because we're not. Well, I'm certainly not. And he had a nightmare return from injury. I was wondering, you know, would Thomas Frank drop him or keep him in the team? And he did, and he's playing very well now. I thought Brentford were unlucky in this game, to be honest. Thought they were the better side in a game that could have gone either way. But yeah, I thought Brentford were worth their points, certainly.
Yeah, I thought both goalkeepers played very well, didn't they? My favourite moment of the game was seeing quite how much faster Armando Broja is than Ben Mee. Ben Mee's around a 20-yard start and Broja got in front. And Mee possibly pulled him down. And then Broja's got to square it and Chelsea score. Johnny, do you have any salient thoughts on this football match?
Well, somebody told me to. I didn't catch up with it until later, and somebody said Kepa was really good. So I watched it, you know, expecting to see like a catalogue of spectacular saves, and I was actually quite disappointed. Most of those saves were quite regulation, but his distribution seems a lot better, and he seems pretty confident. So that's good for him.
Great. Over. Stuart said, would it be better entertainment for the managers to interview each other after the games, not before the games? This is Amazon getting Thomas Frank and Graham Potter on to chat to each other, Troy. Did you like that idea?
Yeah, it's all right. I think they were both very nervous about the question, the one question that they had to ask each other in front of our audience. It was a bit unusual, but it's a nice touch. I'm not sure we're going to get it in all games, but yeah, it was just it's a nice touch to see some interactions before the two managers went to war or their two teams went to war as such.
I guess you have to try these things, don't you? But you sort of think, Barry, the only time it'd be worth doing it is when there are managers who definitely won't talk to each other before the game.
Yeah, there's a good interview in the Times where Matt Dickinson, Thomas Frank has moved into the house into a house on the same street as Matt Dickinson. So Matt Dickinson took him to the local for a couple of pints and an interview, and that, it's worth a read. But my first impression when I saw that is, oh, Dicko's doing.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking as well. Blimey. Brighton 0, Forest 0. Look, Brighton have had 54 shots in their last three games, Johnny, and haven't scored a goal. And we've had this discussion before.
Yeah, I mean, it was there was the first goal under De Zerbi was the 3-3 draw at Liverpool, and when you also look at what he did in Sassuolo, you know, we were all expecting this fiesta of entertainment, and I think they've had three blanks since then. So yeah, I mean, I think it's quite a familiar problem for Brighton that, you know, they are very, very good at progressing the ball, you know, through the thirds, as they say, but it's in that final third where, you know, they come unstuck or need a little bit of luck. I thought Forest were better. Forest looked a little bit more organised than they have done. And that's good for them.
Fulham, Villa and Leicester Leeds are on Thursday night, tonight. And we'll talk about them if they're fascinating on Monday's pod. Well done, Karim Benzema and Alexis Putellas for winning the Ballon d'Or. Benzema's first ever one, scored 44 in 46, helped Real Madrid win the Champions League and La Liga. Sadio Mane was second, Kevin De Bruyne a third. Does anyone care passionately about the Ballon d'Or? Is it a sign that should we have to care because otherwise young people won't listen to the pod anymore?
No, the players really care. The players really, I mean, Mbappe and Neymar and you know, lots of other players have kind of made it their obsession. Rightly or wrongly, I don't know. What I quite like is that there was a load of talk about in this country about how Beth Mead was robbed, and I think she lost by one. I think she lost by one point or one vote to Pateas, and I quite like that. There is a whole new Beth Mead revenge tour is now in the offing. She will be stung by this unforgivable slight and lead us to the World Cup next year.
And even worse than that, there was, I'm not sure, was it the FIFA website or probably wasn't, but some magazine or newspaper or website had a picture of Vivienne Mead and guest.
Yes, yeah, that's ridiculous.
And the guest being Beth Mead, who just finished second.
Yeah, Beth took that in good spirits on Twitter. It was quite funny to see her reply. Arsenal won 5-1, by the way. Arsenal women at Lyon, which is a great result in the Champions League. The Guardian Women's Football Weekly will analyse that in much more detail. And you know, we had so many of these questions.
I'm not sure there's much more detail they can go into, Max. You reading the
Listen,
score.
Troy's got to get a train in 1 minute, hasn't he? So many questions like, John, who would make a better Chief Whip? Sean Dyche, Martin Keown or A.N. Other? Kieran, why did VAR not intervene in the Commons manhandling? Surely Rees-Mogg had to have seen red. Yes, look, thank you for all those political based.
Well, I mean, this is very much one of those podcasts where we'll finish recording and then discover that Liz Truss has gone moments afterwards.
I mean, is this stuff funny? I mean, I find, you know, some of it I find quite funny, but also part of me feels like there's some incredible privilege involved in having a laugh at this stuff. Like this, we
well, there is. I find it funny because I'm not struggling to heat or to eat. I'm not on my uppers. I'm not worrying about how to pay for Christmas. But it's awful.
Yeah, but isn't the point? You make a lot of sense. Isn't the part of the point that people use humor in these difficult stages, and also people come to this podcast for escapism from, you know, like shit things that are happening in their existence? That's certainly the
yeah. I totally get that too, and that is really true and really valid. So I just kind of conflicted about it.
And that will do for today's podcast. Thank you, Johnny.
Thanks.
Thanks, Troy.
Thanks as always, Max.
Cheers, Barry.
Thank you.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove with Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens, and we'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.